chapter 32. We were trying to understand the encounter here between Yaakov and this spiritual entity, that according to our tradition, this spiritual entity represents the essence of Esau, the nation of Esau is like a representation in the spiritual world. It's a force, and this force is struggling with Jacob. What does it mean here in verse number 25? He struggled with him a whole night until the morning. So from here we notice that during the night there was no winner, no loser. If it says here that this entity wasn't able, vayar ki lo yuchalo, this means that ki lo yacholo in verse number 26, this means that he realized that he can't beat him, but this implies that he didn't lose either. So why is it that in verse number 27, once the morning comes, he is defeated, this entity? It says, Vayomer Shalcheni, let me go. Let me go implies that you are winning. You have control over me. The symbolism behind it is the following. We know from other sources, from other places, that the nighttime symbolizes the exile. Why? Because the same way that during the nighttime things aren't clear, you can't tell exactly, you don't see where you're going. You can rely on faith in God, but basically things are dark, they are not clear. When the morning comes, then everything becomes clear all of a sudden. The commentaries say that this is the reason why in the evening when we say the prayers, and we say the statement, Hashem Elokeichem Emet, God is true. This is a statement of belief. We believe that God is true. So when we say it in the morning, we say Hashem Elokeichem Emet, and we follow it with the statement, V'yatziv V'nachon V'kayam, 15 synonyms, which basically mean that this is a fact. Hashem Elokeichem Emet, this is a fact. In the evening, we make the same statement, Hashem Elokeichem Emet, and we follow it with a statement of V'emunah Kol Zot. This is faith. Now, what is the difference between emunah and yatziv v'nachon, between faith and a fact? I can't have faith on something which my own senses testify that this is so. For instance, do I have faith that I'm here, that the table is brown? I don't have faith, I see it. The word faith doesn't come you can't use the word faith for something which for you is a fact. I say, do you have faith that 2 and 2 is 4? It would be a ridiculous statement. I don't have to believe that 2 and 2 is 4. I know, whatever knowing means to the human being, 2 and 2 is 4. I know it. I can only have faith in something which I don't see. For instance, if I tell you, you know, it's raining outside. Now, you don't know whether it's raining or not. Take a raincoat. It's raining outside. So if you have confidence in me, that I wouldn't fool you, you would take a raincoat. This is confidence. This is faith. You have faith in me. You're not sure. You are not there. But you can be as sure as if you are there if you have absolute confidence. If you trust me, if you trust me blindly, then it doesn't really make a difference whether you are outside and you see that it's raining or you are relying on me and you see that it's raining. Basically, you know both things, but there is a difference between knowing through your own experience and you don't know, but you are relying. So, the same way at night. At night, if you can't see, it's dark, and somebody's holding your hand and leading you. So if you have absolute faith in the person who is leading you, so you're not afraid of falling, but it's still faith. You don't know that you're not going to fall. You can't see. But in the morning, you see yourself that you're not falling. Therefore, the exile, the history of the Jewish people during the exile, is compared to the night when things aren't clear, but we have faith in God. We don't understand history. We don't understand why things happen to us. We don't understand. It's dark. But we have faith that if it happened, that was God's will, and that's the way He's leading us. God is leading us in the right direction. It may not look this way, but we believe, right? When will things be clarified? We describe the point in time when history will start making sense, or it will start making sense in retrospect, retroactively. All of a sudden we look at history and say, ah, now we know why this happened. Ah, now we know how that happened. When all the loose ends of history will come together, we have a name for that period. We call it the Messianic period. That's what the Messianic period is all about. The point in time when history will all of a sudden open up for us. We'll finally understand why all this apparently unreasonable things happen to the Jewish people and in history in general, why things happen. So we compare the Messianic era as the morning. All of a sudden things are lit up. This is why in the morning we say Hashem Elokechem Emet, and we say V'yatziv. It's a fact. At night, it's only faith. Doesn't mean that faith can be as strong as something that you know yourself, but it is different. This is faith, and this is something which you know. Now, Esau is our antagonist. He's our antagonist. Esau represents our enemy, our physical enemy, and sometimes our ideological enemy. It's also Esau. So in the exile, we are struggling. We can't beat him. We can't beat him. We can struggle. And the victory is survival. That's all that we can hope for in exile. We can't expect to beat Esau. But we can definitely expect to survive, and the survival is a victory. As a matter of fact, what is the name of Yaakov while he's still struggling in the nighttime? Yaakov. Where does the name come from, Yaakov? The name Yaakov comes from the fact that when they came out of the womb, Yaakov was holding on to the heel of Esau. Now, just imagine the picture. If you are holding on to somebody's heel, so if he's very strong and you are weak, what is going to happen? He's going to drag you. If you are strong, you can hold him. But you can't get rid of him. If you are holding on to his heel, your destiny is together with him. It's tied to his. This is our problem with Esau. Our destiny is tied to Esau in this exile. All we can hope for is to be strong enough, and through our strength we can even control a little bit the movements of Esau. If we are weak, we are going to be dragged by Esau. But our destiny is to hold his heel. That's all. It's only in the morning that the victory is finally complete. In the morning we are in complete control. We are on top of him. And he can't move without us, right? That is the final victory, okay? Now, what happens next? The fact that during the night, even though he couldn't beat us, but he made some damage. What was the damage that he did? He actually damaged our hip, right? So in the Torah it says later on, that at the end he came out limping, Jacob, victorious but limping. And in verse number 33, Al-Kain, Lo yochlu bnei Yisrael et gid hanasheh. The Jews from that point on, the children of Israel, don't eat anymore the gid hanasheh, which means the sinew, that part of the muscle. Asher al kaf hayarech ad hayom hazeh. Why? Ki naga bekaf yerech Yaakov begid hanasheh. Because there was a damage there. And we must remember that there was a damage. So what's the big deal that there was a damage? So the commentaries tell us that in this damage lies problem, the constant danger to Jewish survival, the damage of the hip. What is the symbolism of the damage of the hip? Let's try to take the symbol, the hip. The hip is the part which connects the body of a person with the legs of a person. Right? That's the part, the hip. Now, the legs of a person represent movement. You move from one place to the other. The body of the person, that's the steady part. Right? That's the permanent part. That permanent part of his moves, and the legs represent movement. Now, The body of the Jewish people throughout the exile, what do? They move from one place to another. And every time they move, there is an enormous danger, because the Jews come to the new place and they want to immediately, they want to adjust to the culture of the new place, to the values of the new place. And immediately there is a drive for assimilation, giving up what we are. That is the pain of the movement, the pain of moving from one place to the other. Every time we come to a new place, we want to adjust again. The Jew, more than any other group, wants to be modern. He wants to be part of the environment. He's an enormous drive of being part of the environment, but at the same time, he also has a loyalty to his body, to his past. So the adjustment is extremely difficult. So basically, assimilation is the symbol of the hip, and this is where the Midrash brings it down. That what is the Gid HaNasheh, what is this pain in the hip? It's the damage, the losses that we had throughout history through the exile, through the movements of the exile. This is what we have to remember, that at night there is a tremendous price for survival, and that is assimilation and intermarriage. Now, what is the meaning then of the change of the name? In the morning, he's not Yaakov anymore, he becomes Israel. Now, what does the word Israel mean? Israel means to overcome. The same way that Yaakov implies struggle, holding his heel, struggle. Israel, right? Kisarisa, Kisarita, what does it mean, Sarita? You were able to overcome. So when is our name Israel? Only in the Messianic period. The reason why we call ourselves Israel now, it's a borrowed name from our future. Here, our name today is still Yaakov. We are still struggling. But we call ourselves Israel, B'nai Israel. We are the nation of Israel. Why? Because we have such a certainty that someday we will overcome Esau, that we take that name and we use it for today. Like we borrowed it from the future for the present. And this is the meaning of Shema Yisrael. Understand? Israel. Hashem Elokeinu, God our God. Hashem Echad. Now, what is the real meaning of understand or listen, Israel? God is one. You know what it really means, God is one? It's not only a statement of fact, God is one, but it's a statement of belief in the eventual eventual coming of the Messiah. Why? Because we say also in the prayer, Bayom Hahu, when that day will come, then it will be Hashem Echad, God will be one, Ushmo Echad, and his name will be one. Now, what does that mean? Today he's not one. No. What it really means is that the day will come when he will be perceived as one. Today, God is not perceived as one. We believe He's one. We don't perceive Him as one, because the oneness of God would be perceived as the only controller of our lives, the only controller of history. Do we perceive Him this way? Unfortunately not. We, on the surface, seem to think that there are our other forces that control history and that control our lives. That is a limitation in the oneness of God. If we would be able to perceive the complete oneness of God, that would be the perception that Ein Od Milvado, He's so much one that there is nothing else besides Him. What does it mean? That is the complete oneness, the complete control. Today, we don't sense it. We don't perceive it. But we are sure that the day will come that it will become obvious that there is only one controller. That means Hashem Echad, the perception of the oneness of God. So when we say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad is, listen, O Israel. Now, your name is Israel. Why? Because we believe that Hashem Echad someday will be perceived as one. Okay? This is the idea of the change of names. That the nature of Yaakov will change once that the morning time will come, and at that point he will be Israel. Now, there is another very, very important thing that happens here. In verse number 28, Vayomer Elav, the angel asks Jacob, Mashemecha, what is your name? And Yaakov answers, my name is Yaakov. And they said, no, not anymore. Now it's Israel. What was the purpose of asking him his name, right? Why does the angel ask his name? And Yaakov says, yes, this is my name. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the meaning of a name. What is the idea behind the name? There is, for instance, in Deuteronomy, a whole portion about keeping the name alive of a dead person. Yibum, exactly. Keeping the name alive. A person dies, so if he has children, he has no problem with his name. Why? Because somehow his children will carry his name. But if he dies without children, his name will be forgotten. So there is a whole thing, a whole plan that the Torah has, how you can maintain his name. By his brother marrying his widow. Remember that law? The law of the Yibum, the levirate marriage. And then they have children, and the children will carry the name of the dead person too. And then it says, and if he refuses to do it, then the woman should go and pull off his shoe. If he refuses to do it, the brother. And the commentaries say, the Maharal of Prague says, what is the idea behind it? He says, well, the idea of the name, it's not only a name. The name of someone means the essence of his soul. That's what the name is. The reason why we have a name is because we recognize the distinction between each person. There is something which is basically different between each one of us. Every human being is different. And that difference is pointed out by the Shem, in Hebrew, name, Shin Mem. If you see in front of your eyes the word for soul in Hebrew. How do you say soul in Hebrew? Neshama. Nun, Shin, Mem, Hey. And if you remove the outer letters, the beginning letter and the last letter of the word Neshama, in other words, you're removing the Nun and you remove the Hey, what have you got left? Word Shem. So the word Shem represents the essence of the soul. So a person having a name means a person who is able to fulfill his special goal in life. He has kept his name. This is what we say a name is. Yeah.
Is that why we call Hashem Hashem? Does that mean like the name that the Yoikev Amkid were not allowed to say?
Well, a little bit of it is true, because it's too much of his essence. So, you know, we don't relate to that essence of his. Yeah, but the shame of Hashem is really his function. The function of God which I'm perceiving. This is what the shame of Hashem means.
But the little word Hashem translates.
Or the word shame, the name, Ushmo Echad. Right? Right?
Hashem.
Hashem. Hashem, right. The
name.
The name, right.
Hashem.
What?
Hashem stands for par excellence, the name that is the
right.
Greatest.
Exactly.
The
exactly.
Best.
Right. Interior. Right. Now, I don't know if you're aware, there is a whole thing, I don't know if it could be that some of you saw it in the prayer book. There is a certain custom that at the end of the daily prayers that we say three times a day, right before you finish the Amidah, you should say a sentence, a verse of the Bible, which either contains your name, or that the beginning letter of the verse and the end letter of the verse coincide with the beginning and end letter of your name. I don't know if you ever saw it. And there is a very strange midrash, a very strange tradition which says, the reason for this is that when a person leaves this world and he stands in the divine court and they ask him, what is your name? You will be so shocked that you won't be able to answer. Therefore, this prayer will help you that you should be able to remember your name. That's very, very strange. I mean, what's the point? I mean, so, in the commentaries, it says that the idea of remembering your name, it means that you should remember that you have a special function in this world. if a person didn't find his special function, his special goal in life, he has forgotten his name. The idea is when you leave this world and you stand in front of the divine court, you should be able to tell your name, which means you should be able to stand up and say, yes, I have fulfilled my function. My name hasn't been forgotten. Okay? This is the idea behind it, the idea of remembering your name. So this is why it says that sometimes you can transfer this function to your future generations. So if so, you have maintained your name. Now, by the way, it also says, it's a verse in the prophet Isaiah, that sometimes, even if a person dies without children, he can have a purpose. In other words, he can have fulfilled his purpose with, it's an interesting because there is an institution with this name, Yad Vashem. Isaiah says, God says that I will give you the possibility to have a hand and a name, Yad Vashem. What does it mean, a hand? You can build something physical that will serve a positive purpose for future generations, and that will be your yad, your hand. And you can do something positive in the ideological arena. I mean, you can study Torah and teach Torah, and then you will have a name. Or if people will study Torah because of you, because you have established a yad, a building where they can study Torah, so you will have a Yad Vashem. So it's very interesting. For the victims of the Holocaust, they built an institution and they called it, very properly, Yad Vashem, which means even though many of them died, they didn't leave any remnants, but at least this will be the remembrance for them. So that's why they call it Yad Vashem. Again, the same idea, that something should be maintained in this world which is associated with the name. So, according to the commentaries, when the angel says to Yaakov, what is your name? And Yaakov says, Yaakov is my name, right? It's not like an insignificant dialogue. There is a significance. The significance is that during the night, he didn't forget his name. He has maintained his goal. He didn't erase it. He didn't become so involved in the struggle that he even forgot his name, which means he forgot the function of Yaakov in the night. So since he remembered the name, he says, you remember your name. So therefore now you deserve to change your name to a higher level. Yaakov becomes Israel. But now there is something else which is very strange. Yaakov asks him, here in verse number 30, Vayishal Yaakov ayomer hagida na shemecha. So now tell me your name. Right? So, Vayomer, and the angel answers, Lama ze tishal lishmi? Why do you ask my name? What kind of an answer is it? He just asked him a question, what is your name? So, does he have a name or doesn't he have a name? If he does have a name, say so. Right? As a matter of fact, we know what his name is. The oral tradition says, this is the angel Malacho Shel Esav. He is the spiritual force which represents Esau. Why doesn't he say his name? Why does he hide it? Right? Lama ze tishal lishmi? Why do you ask my name? Or say clearly, I don't want to tell you. What kind of an answer is it to answer a question with a question? Right?
A Jewish
answer, you say. Lama, why do you answer? Oh, and this satisfies Jacob. So why doesn't he insist? What's the point here? So they say over this principle, which I'm going to tell you, in the name of the main one of the disciples of the Gaon of Vilna. You heard about the Gaon of Vilna, the great, great sage of the 18th century. He had many disciples, but the top disciple was somebody called Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin. And Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin once gave over the following principle. He said like this, in the laws, Maimonides has many laws. Here's a list of laws concerning our relationship with other nations. Right? For instance, we have a certain restrictions in our obligations, in our relationship with the Moabites, with the Ammonites, with the Egyptians. In the Torah, there are certain restrictions, what we are allowed to do with them, what we are not allowed to do with them, etc., etc. You're not allowed to marry a Moabite man, for instance. So Maimonides quotes these laws concerning the restrictions that we have with the Moabites and Ammonites and Edomites and Egyptians, and then he adds Ukvar Avad Zichram, which means, but now, the Maimonides, that goes back 900 over 9 about 1,000 years. So he says, but today it's irrelevant. That's what he means. Kvar Avad Zichram. Today it's irrelevant. Why? Because today we don't know who is a Moabite, we don't know who is an Egyptian. It's not the people in Egypt today are not the original Egyptians. So therefore we have no idea who they are. Therefore all these laws are irrelevant today. They have no bearing today practically. There's no way that you can practically fulfill them because we don't know who they are. Why? Because at a certain point in history, all the nations became so mixed up, we don't know who is who anymore. We know, we barely know that we are Jewish, but we don't even know which tribe we belong to, except for some priests that they remember that they are priests. The rest of us, do we know? Do we belong do we come from Benjamin, from Judah, perhaps from the other 10 tribes that some of them returned to the Jewish people? Perhaps we come from Gerim, we have no idea. We lost the knowledge of our real identity. And the world in general lost it. They lost their roots. Fine? Clear? True? Then a paragraph later, the same chapter in Maimonides, and he says like this, and we Jews are obligated to uproot, to destroy the memory of Amalek. If we could find a person who is an Amalek, we would have the obligation to destroy him. He's the enemy of Israel, Amalek. So therefore, we have to destroy him. He's our pursuer, right? Now, the question is so obvious. What is the obvious question? He just finished saying before, we don't know who the Moabite is, we don't know who the Ammonite is, and then, how do we know who the Amalekite is? He just finished saying that it's impossible to know. And then, right after that, it does it, but we still have the obligation to kill the Amalek, to destroy Amalek, but we still don't know who he is. So, what can we infer from Maimonides? That we do know who he is. How do we know who he is? Do we have his genealogy? We don't have his genealogy. The answer is that Amalek, the descendant of Esau, remember, Amalek is the worst descendant of Esau. All the evil of Esau is concentrated in Amalek. In other words, if Esau is bad, Amalek has the concentration of all the evil in Esau. How do we know who he is? Very simple test. His actions tell us who he is. All the other nations, the Moabite, we can't tell. And since we don't have their genealogy, so that's it. We don't know who he is. A person can become a converted Amalekite. In order to do that, all you have to do is to transform your ideology. We know exactly what is the ideology of Amalek. Someone who believes that for the well-being of the world, we must destroy the Jewish people. It's an ideology. The ideology is, and many, many people had it throughout history, it's good for the world to purify itself by getting rid of the Jews. It's a common ideology which keeps coming, which keeps existing in all generations of history. According to our tradition, that there is no generation without it. Sometimes they would hide it, they would hide this ideology. Sometimes they would come out openly with this ideology. But bechol dor vodor, in every single generation, there are some people who are the Amalekites of the generation. That could be that they even change. Today it could be the Russian, tomorrow it could be the German, the day after tomorrow it could be somebody else. Which means there is no guarantee that the same ones who were the Amalekites 2 generations ago will be the Amalekites of today, and they'll be the Amalekites of tomorrow. Meaning, if you can be an adopted Amalekite, you can never tell who will come up with the same ideology tomorrow, and he will be the Amalekite. Comes out according to this. Does Amalek have a real name? Right? In other words, can we call him, well, the Germans, the Russians, the Turks? We can't. He changes. He constantly changes. It's his goal that makes him an Amalekite. Amma is made up of which? 2 parts. Le means what? To ma, what? What purpose? For what purpose? Okay? So very often you can interchange the word madua for the word lama, but basically they mean 2 different things. Madua means which is the information which I'm missing, and lama means what is the purpose. So when he says, Loma, what was the answer of the question, of Jacob's question, what is your name? Lomo ze tishalishmi. Lomo means, for what purpose? That's a hint that the purpose is what makes him Esau, Amalek. It's the purpose. Le ma. What does it mean, le ma? For what goal? The goal makes you into what I am. Don't ask my name. Today I'm called such and such nation. It makes no difference. Next generation, the name will change. But the lema will be the same. So in the word lema, that on the surface means why, is a hint to the answer. Lema, you just see the purpose. When you find a group which has as its goal the wiping out of the Jewish people, then it's me. So you should know it for the future. Okay, this is what the answer of the angel is to Yaakov.
So we gave an answer.
So that was the answer, which means that the question, Lomo zeti shalishmi, is an answer. So now it makes sense. It's not an irrelevant dialogue. What is your name? What do you care? And what's the point? No. That is the answer. Lomo zeti shalishmi. My name changes. That itself is the point that he's making.
So that Amalek does not have generations. It's by his actions.
Exactly, exactly. You don't have to search his genealogical tree. For his actions tell you he's an Amalek. Now, let's go on in chapter number 33. In chapter 33 is the encounter, the actual encounter between Yaakov and Esav. We'll skip a little bit. In verse number 4, in verse number 4 it says, Vayarotz Esav likrato. And Esau just ran in front of him, Vayichabkeyu. And he embraced him, Esav embraced Jacob, Vayipol al tzavarav. He fell, it's an expression, he fell, we say he fell on his shoulders. The expression in Hebrew is, he fell on his neck. Same idea. Vayishakehu, and he kissed him. Now, do you notice that on top of the word Vayishakehu and he kissed him, there are dots. Every letter has a dot. Vayivku, and they cried. What is the meaning of the dots? So Rashi quotes the two opinions. And it's very interesting that they seem to be opposite opinions. You have, for instance, Yesh Cholkim B'davar Hazeh, says Rashi. Yesh Shedarshu Nekuda Zu. Some understand the dots. The dot always comes to erase. You know that in the olden days, you know, when we find old manuscripts, when they made a mistake, I don't mean when they wrote the Torah, there couldn't be any mistake. If there was, they would erase it and redo it. But what about if you find a manuscript of, let's say, the Talmud, for instance? Let's say there was a mistake. Somebody wrote one word twice, and you want to erase it. They don't erase it. They don't make a line. They make dots on top of it. That's the way it is. The idea is erasing means that the meaning that it seems to have on the surface, change it. That's the idea of the dots on top. So, this is why they say the following in the oral tradition. Shelo nashku becholibo. You might think that Esau kissed him with his full heart, with full intention. So this is what the dots come to tell you. No, you're making a mistake. It wasn't full-heartedly. In other words, it wasn't with his full heart. It wasn't with full intention. Not with his whole heart. Omar Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Comes Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, says the exact opposite. It's not true what you are saying. Halachahi, the halacha is, the halacha means not necessarily the law. It could mean a natural law. It's a natural law. Biyadua she'esav soneh le'Yaakov. Esau hates Jacob. That's a rule. It's a rule of nature. It's a law of nature. So if there are dots here, it seems that here the law of nature doesn't apply. that in those moments he was able to overcome the hatred. He did it, kiss him with his whole heart. Which means that according to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, he gives tremendous credit to Esau. That in spite of the fact that Esau is evil, he has potentially the power to overcome his evil in certain moments. And in those moments you can really trust him. He's doing it with his whole heart. This is the argument between Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and the other point of view. According to the other point of view, the rule is the rule. Esau will never be nice to Jacob, ever. Beware of him. Always keep away from him. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is saying, it's true, as a rule that is true. But sometimes when he kisses us, he means it 100%. You can rely on him on this point. What? Well, you never, that's the problem. The problem means you never know. But when you look at it in retrospect, and you find that at certain times Esau was very nice to Jacob, don't think that it contradicts the rule. The rule is still the rule. And those few moments are the exception of the rule. So just the opposite, Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai is telling you, don't base your behavior on those small moments, very short moments, where he really meant it. Don't base your behavior on that. Just because Esau was nice to you for about 1 hour, don't say, well, you see, he's capable, so I can trust him. Don't trust him. Right? That's what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is telling you. So what happens here? They see each other in verse number 5, and they everybody comes over, and they all bow down to him. And Jacob wants to give him the presents. And look what it says in verse number 9. Vayomer Esav. So Esav says, thank you, I don't want to accept all your presents. Yesh li rav, I have a lot. Why do I need more? I have so many things. I'm so wealthy. I don't need your presents. Achi, my brother, whatever you have, keep. Don't give me the presents. So Jacob insists. Right? So he says in verse number 11, Kach na et birchati, take my blessing, which means my present, asher huvat lach. Ki chanani Elokim, because God gave me things, favored me, v'chiyesh li kol, I have everything. Do you hear the difference between how Esau expresses his appreciation for what he has? So what does he say? I have what? In verse number 9, I have a lot, rav. And how does Yaakov say it? Yesh li kol, I have everything. I have everything. So, according to our tradition, this statement of Jacob, I have everything, describes the nature of Yaakov, saying, I have everything. We describe it as complete satisfaction of what you have. Right? In the words of the rabbis, Sameach Bechelko, you are happy with your share. Right? Why? Because obviously there is no person in the world who has everything. No one in the world. Let's say the richest man in the world. He doesn't have everything. I have a suit, it's mine, not his. I have a car, it's mine, not his. So how can he say he has everything? The word everything doesn't mean that he actually has everything. Everything which is valuable to him, this is what it means. Whatever I don't have, I really don't need. If you have that attitude, that whatever I don't have, I really don't need, so then it's worth zero whatever I don't have. So what does it end up? That you do have everything. You hear the idea of I have everything? Now, in the Birchat Hamazon, in the prayer after the meal, we say a prayer after we finish the benching, the four blessings. It says that we ask God to give us the blessings of our forefathers, our patriarchs. God should give us bakol, in everything, mikol, from everything, kol, everything. It's such a strange demand from God. Give us bakol, mikol, and kol. So the commentaries say, what does it mean? Because when God blesses Abraham, it says, and God blessed Abraham, Vashem beirach et Abraham, bakol. So bakol is the code word for Abraham's blessing. Mikol is the code word for Isaac's blessing, because when Eliezer came to find a wife, he brought mikol tuvadonav, Everything which Isaac hid was Mikol, from everything. But Jacob is in a higher level. He has Kol, he has everything. And everything is even higher than Mikol and Bakol. Kol is everything. What does it mean? What is the idea behind it? So the commentaries say the following insights, a very subtle, very important insight. You know that according to our tradition, each one of our patriarchs excelled in a specific area. Avram Avinu, Abraham, excelled in his kindness, in his generosity. Chesed, that was the characteristic in which Avram Avinu excelled. Isaac excelled in his extreme subservience to God, the tremendous control that he had over himself to become completely subservient to God. Right? That's how you picture Isaac, lying on the altar, giving up his life for God. That is the characteristic of Isaac. And Jacob, the main characteristic of Jacob is his search for truth. He always struggled with the truth. He struggled to get the truth. Now, a person who is really honest and is looking for truth, right? And that's all that matters to him. Emet, there is nothing else which is important but the truth. So, such a person has such an insight into the meaning of life, right? If a person reaches the highest point of truth and he recognizes that life has a meaning and it has a purpose. So obviously, if God gave me something, it's worthwhile to have it. If God didn't give it to me, it's not worthwhile to have it. I mean, I wish, you know, if everybody would be in such a level, we would all be happy. The fact that we are not so happy is because we are not convinced that what we don't have is not important. Because we are lacking in the insight of truth. We are lacking in Emet. We are lacking in Torah. If we would be able to reach the highest level in Emet, in Torah, we would recognize exactly what Yaakov recognizes. That he has everything. And that everything which he doesn't have is not worthwhile. What does Esau say? Yeshli rov. Rov means it's true, I have a lot. But in the word rov, there is an implication. There is a lot which I don't have and I still want. That's the implication, right? That's the ambition. The ambition of Esau, is hinted in the word rov, I have a lot. As opposed to Yaakov. Yaakov is 100% satisfied with his kol, with everything which he has. Even though Esau at this point is much wealthier than Yaakov, it's still Yaakov who has everything, and Esau is still... he still has the ambition for more. Now let's go on a little bit. Listen to this offer which Esau presents, that Esau offers to Yaakov, that Esau offers to Yaakov in verse number 12. You'd bet. Vayomer, nis'a v'neilecha v'elcha l'negdecha. You know what? Let's go together. You will go here, and I will go here. Let's travel together, says Esau to Jacob. So, in verse number 13, Yaakov's answer. Vayomer elav. So Yaakov says, Adoni, my master, Yodea, you know, ki ha'iladim, the children, rakim, are soft, young. My children are young, says Yaakov to Esau. Etc., etc. I'm afraid of the children and of my son and bakar, my property, I'm afraid. So you know what? Verse number 14. Yavar no Adoni lifnei avdo. You go up front. You know what? Don't wait for me. Va'ani, and I, Yaakov, et nahala le'iti. I'll go according to my pace. I won't follow your pace. I'll follow my pace. Le'regel hamlacha, because I have so much work, asher lefanai. Ule'regel ha'iladim, and I have children. So you go, and I'll go at my own pace. Why would such a conversation be recorded for eternity in the Torah? The commentaries say that in this offer, the offer of Esau, let's move together, was an offer to make up for what was lost before. If you remember, we mentioned that when Isaac wants to give the blessing to Esau, what he has in mind. Remember what he has in mind? He has in mind that Esau and Jacob should form the perfect partnership. That Yaakov and Esau should work together, and as a team, they'll fulfill the purpose of what Isaac wants his descendants to do in this world. Yaakov will take care of all the spiritual matters, and Esau will take care of all the physical matters, and together they'll form a perfect team. This is what he's offering now again. You know what, says Esau to Yaakov? We are friends again. Let's rectify what we lost. Let's do it all over again. So what's Yaakov's answer? No, I'm afraid. I'm afraid for what? The children. What does it mean, I'm afraid for the children? The future. I'm afraid for the influence. You will influence them. You'll want to destroy them. I'll work at my own pace and you'll work at your own pace. Let's not go together. Let's forget about the partnership. So the offer of Esau is refused right now. Okay, we'll stop here. Continue.